Hey y'all, my name is Dina and I'm a crystal meth addict. Hey y'all. My sobriety date is August the 26th, 2008. I have a sponsor. I've always had a sponsor. My sponsor, a couple women, sometimes they sponsor me back. I carry a meeting into a treatment facility in my community because I just think it's that important to let people know that, you know, we get better. And so I am supposed to share my experience, strength, and hope with you and give a little bit about what it was like and what happened and what it's like today. Honestly, I'm the only daughter. I have four brothers. I'm the middle child, of course, the wild child. I grew up, my mom and dad were married. I had a great childhood. We held hands and said the blessing. We were at the football field. My parents were the coaches. I was the homecoming queens. I mean, you name it. It was like this perfect little, scenario for growing up. And when I was about 12, my mom sat us all down and told us that she and my dad were getting divorced. And we were like, what? And so that was a little crazy. So that was probably like the weirdest thing that happened to me as a child. You know, we had no idea. My brothers and I were shocked. We thought everything was great and we had this great family. And then we realized that really we had been living a lie, I guess. You know, apparently my dad was an alcoholic. We didn't know that either. Go figure. And so my mom and dad got divorced and my dad's alcoholism went crazy. And, you know, I like to say sometimes that like the first thing I was addicted to was like chaos, because that's what happened when my parents split up. My dad moved or stayed in Tennessee with his girlfriend that we didn't know about either. And my brothers and my mom and I stayed, you know, here. And my dad was crazy. He would get drunk and he would call my mom in the middle of the night and say he's going to come kill everybody. And so my mom would wake us up all up in the middle of the night and we would have to, you know, pack a 3-thing bag, you know, and escape in the middle of the night. And he would come in and tear the house apart and we would come home and it was crazy, but I loved it. Like, I loved it. I mean, the sound of breaking glass and sirens was my thing. You know, I liked that. It turns out it was kind of fun for me. And I think it was kind of one of those things where like, I at school I was this one person, then at home it was like crazy and I loved it. It was kind of like I was just keeping the family tradition alive. You know, we're living two lives. Apparently that's what they were doing. But you know, when I think back even before that, I remember, I can remember being in church on a Wednesday night, and I remember someone had told us how you can make yourself pass out, right? And you can like bend over and you breathe real heavy a bunch, and then somebody comes up behind you and grabs you by the waist and you pass out, and then you come to, and it's like, and you're supposed to like all rotate and take turns, but like I didn't, like one person watches the door, one person is the puller, one person's the breather, and you know, and I just remember like I didn't want to watch the door, like I don't want to hold your back, like I want to be the one that passes out every single time, and I remember that, like that's a true story. I remember, you know, in fifth grade, this is like before, you know, when life was still good. I remember bringing home rubber cement and sitting in front of my closet and like smelling rubber cement while I was supposed to be cleaning out my closet and falling backwards in the floor. And I was born with this thing, y'all. I mean, and I never felt different. I never felt like I didn't fit in. I felt like I always fit in, but I loved the way that stuff made me feel, you know, and that's just all there is to it. I wish I had some, you know, crazy story about, you know, not fitting in and feeling different, and alcohol or drugs just made me feel different. It just made me feel better, and I wanted to feel better. The first time I drank alcohol, it was after I found out my dad was an alcoholic, I was like, well, that sounds like fun. And my next door neighbor's dad was an alcoholic, and he had a refrigerator downstairs, and my best friend and I remember reading the Jack Daniels, a black and white bottle, like Jack Daniels upside down, and just like turning it up. Like I was that way from the start. I mean, wasted drunk, drank straight Jack Daniels from the bottle, like a 70-year-old man or something. Ran around the neighborhood, ran into trees and telephone poles, puked all over the bathroom, and woke up the next morning. I was like, wow, you know, like, what's next? You know, I think I was just born with this disease. The first time I ever smoked pot, I remember sitting around a group of people and they, you know, we all passed the joint around. And after it was done, I was like, I don't feel anything. I need my own joint. Can we do some more? Like, I need another one. And then finally, at some point, they were just probably to shut me up. I got my own little, small little personal joint, and they gave me the joint just to shut me up because, like, I always wanted more. It was never enough for me. I always wanted more. In high school, so the crazy chaos, my mom and, you know, my dad, by the time my dad sobered up, and when I was in high school, my dad sobered up, but by then I was freaking alcoholic, you know, drinking every opportunity that I could. Smoking pot every opportunity that I could. In high school, my best friend was actually Kim Kay. Some of you guys may know her from, she did a lot of service work in this area, and she was amazing. And she was my best friend in high school, and she was also my sponsor when I first got sober. In fact, when we were driving here, Wendy and I were driving here, and I remember the very first, I had court like on a Tuesday, and I went to CMA in Douglasville that night. And then on Friday night, I remember being in the parking lot with Kim and my brother. And everybody's like, you know, I was doing that thing where, like, nobody will give me money, but everybody will, like, take me grocery shopping. And I was in that phase of early recovery. Like literally, like, fresh off the pipe. And I remember Kim saying to my brother, she was like, yeah, so there's another meeting that I really love, and we're going to it. It's called Galano at CMA, and it's downtown. And I was like, wait a minute. I was like, can we do that? You know, like, can we go downtown? I had no idea. And then I realized that really all I'd been doing for the past 5 years at least was going from bathroom to den to dope house to bathroom. You know what I mean? Like, my world was so small. And usually, you know, in high school, me and Kim came to Atlanta not to go to CMA. So I was like, are you sure that's a good idea? And she was like, yes, Dina, it's okay. And I was like, this is probably like some kind of sneaky shit she's up to. You know, like, I'm probably going to get to drink or something. That didn't happen. But anyway, so that was my high school life. My dad got sober and started preaching AA and telling me about how you eat an elephant one bite at a time. And I was just like, I don't like elephant. You know, like, nothing you're saying to me makes any sense. None of that is, you know, one day at a time. Okay, Dad, like, what else do we got? You know, none of it made sense to me. But he got sober. I was alcoholic. So there's that. And that's in high school. I was a great drinker. I was a blackout drinker. Like, that's what I want to do. If I wake up and I know where I'm at, I probably didn't drink good enough. You know, I want to wake up in a strange place and not know anybody and try to figure out, it's like a scavenger hunt or something, trying to figure out how I get back to where I started, you know? That's just how I did it. And I started dating this guy, and we were, like, partying, and we were, you know, we would do a little ecstasy here and there, and we were partying and drinking, and I was like, I'm a pretty good drinker. I wasn't drinking wine coolers anymore. You know, I was, like, getting cases of beer or, you know, shots of this, and, but we, you know, by the time I was, like, hanging out with these guys and partying with them, and like I would be about like I'm like okay I'm trying it's time to tap out, you know, we're at the Waffle House booth and I'm like starting to slump down a little bit, it's time to go home, and these guys were just going and I was like, what is going on, you know, like these guys party like I want to be like them when I grow up. Turns out I managed to do that. What happened was we were getting ready to go out one night, and you know, I'd been drinking everything, and the guy that I was dating reached over my pantry in my kitchen and pulled out his stash of it was crank at the time, and laid it out on the table and my kitchen counter, and I was like, what is that, you know? And my history of drug education is the whole this is your brain on drugs, right? Don't do cocaine, okay, don't do pills, you know, the man's in the bottle of pills and a pill bottle trapped in there, and I'm like, that doesn't look fun. So I didn't do pills, you know, I didn't do cocaine because I didn't want to push my family down a street in a buggy. And like, I just remember, like, those are the things that I remember about drugs. But I had heroin. I mean, are you kidding me? I'm banging your frying pan around the kitchen. So nobody, that was scary, right? So I never did any of those drugs, but there was never one for meth or crank. So I mean, I guess that was just what I was looking for. And anyway, so he laid out a line and he did his little line and I was like, what is that? And he's like, oh, it's just speed, you know, it'll help you clean the house. And I'm looking around. And I'm looking around and I'm like, I mean, the house is clean, but I don't know how to say no, right? I don't want to say no. I don't want to be missing out on something. And no one's ever said to me that this is dangerous or that I'll be stealing from my grandmother later. And, you know, people crack me up when they're like, you know, why did you do meth? Didn't you know what was in it? And I was like, not until I had done it. And once I did it, you could have told me there were body parts in it. I'd be like, okay, pass the pipe. Like, I'm past the let, pass it. You know, I don't care what's in it. By the time I'm hooked on it, I don't care what's in it, right? So of course, I did my first line of crank, and I was hooked. I mean, I literally spent 10, 11 years romancing that and, you know, nurturing that habit. And the problem was I didn't really know what it was. I didn't know where to get it. I didn't know anything about it. So, like, I was like a little bird, you know, and I would just, like, wait for him to bring the meth home and, you know, like chirping and, like, waiting for the food. And, you know, when he felt like it, when he wanted to do it, then we got to do it. So we were the weekend warriors. That's what we, you know, I'm surprised we didn't get T-shirts made. But we would be Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday. On Sunday, we would rest. We would eat. We would go to a buffet. You know, we would catch up on all the things. And then on Monday, we would all go to work, and it would be, you know, and it worked out great for me. I was starting all these projects at work. It was amazing, and I was, like, I was moving up, and I was, like, creating things at work, and, you know, and then I would do that thing where I would, like, plan this huge event and invite the whole community, and then I would, like, oversleep and, like, not show up with the keys. And you know, so that's when it started getting bad. And I remember the very first time I woke up on a Monday, and, because I guess at some point the Saturday night carried over into Sunday. But I remember specifically looking in my mirror in my apartment on a Monday morning and realizing, oh, my God, like, I need it today. Like, I'm not supposed to need it on Monday. You know, and I did. I needed it on Monday. But, you know, I was snorting it, and I was eating it, putting it in my coffee, and it didn't really feel like I was doing anything, really. It was just kind of like cream and sugar and meth, and, you know, it was like, it didn't feel like I was doing anything terribly wrong, you know. And then, let's see, so that relationship, you know, at some point, still, I never, ever learned how to get it in that relationship. So it was always, so what I learned how to do very early on, he worked in a body shop, which at some point we called home. But at some point he would, like, take it out from his stash, you know, and wherever he would hide it, and he would throw it in the office, because I was the office manager. He would give it to me, and he would say, like, we would put it in tissue paper. Y'all old school people know what I'm talking about. So we would put it in tissue paper, and we'd eat it. You know, it's like taking our vitamins or something. And so he would throw the bag in there, you know, and it would be like enough time for me to get. I would make me one, twist the little lid, you know, put it down, and then I would get some toilet paper, put it in some toilet paper, twist the little lid, dust it around in the bag a little bit, right? So he was doing toilet paper, and then I would scoop out, what I should have put in the, and so I always had a stash. I did that the whole time, right? I mean, in every relationship, I always was like, I'm always like getting more meth. That's all I really wanted to do. I feel like I was like way more strung out than all the people I was hanging out with, because I was like doing more dope than them. I was stealing from us, you know, like. So that relationship got crazy, and, you know, and that thing that happens, like, he would go to sleep and sleep for a little while, you know, a few days or whatever, and not me. I'm like, you know, I would, like, doze off occasionally, but I've still got a pocket full of meth. So when we run out, I'm like, and sleep, right? And then I'm going to town, and I'm doing the rest of the meth. So That relationship did not last because what I figured out is I didn't know how to get it, but I at some point figured out who to get it from. And so I started dating that guy. okay. So I broke up with the guy that introduced me to meth and started dating his dope dealer because that's what we do, or that's what I do. But during that time of that relationship, like I said, I was like homeless during some of that. My mom and dad started getting really worried about me and tried to do like interventions. And like the first intervention, my mom showed up at the house and the house was, of course, it was a wreck, you know, and there's like, the clothes are like, they're not like whites and darks and they're like yellows and purples and blues and greens. And, you know, like I hadn't done laundry. I'd arranged laundry all month, but I didn't do any of it. And so they came in and they were like, what's going on with you? And I was like, I'm depressed. Right. And so I played the depression card for as long as I could. And then, you know, once I moved into the dope house, my life got really crazy, really, really fast. You know, I grew up in a great home with a great mom. She was a stay-at-home mom. She vacuumed our floor every day. Like, I grew up in, I had a great home life and a good little foundation. But I was living in a dope house with padlocks on the doors. And there was kids were living, you know, he had two older kids that were like in high school. And I remember seeing what turned out to be my stepson because, I mean, I'm not a dope whore. I'm going to marry this man. But I remember seeing it, you know, I say it, you know, my humor is really what's kept me alive, but I say it, but it really, it turns my stomach and it hurts my heart. But I remember seeing him sitting at the kitchen table on his little laptop and like cockroaches just like crawl. I mean, it was horrible. It was disgusting. And my brother was actually a cop, which that's always fun to be the meth addict in a cop family. And so they were trying to get me, my mom and family were trying, you know, they were trying to reach out to me. My mom was sending me emails and saying things like, this Chicken Little, the sky is falling. And I was like, well, won't be reading emails anymore. Like, that didn't sound like fun. So my brother and my mom, in an attempt to save my life, really, I mean, I joke about it, but I mean, they were terrified. They had no idea. Like, my grandmother used to call me her heart, you know, and I was stealing medicine. I was stealing needles from her to trade for dope. I was stealing her Valium to trade for meth. I mean, it was horrible. She was like, what is going on with you? Like, you used to dress so cute and you used to always be so nice and like wear shoes and like, what's wrong with you? like walk around in socks, like, everywhere, like, just, it was horrible. But anyway, so my brother and them, there was a search warrant for the house that I was living in, and on any given day you could have come in there and there would have been a million people in there, but on the day they decided to come in there, I was the only person there. So the SWAT team, Cobb County SWAT team, came in, and I was scared, and like shields, black guns, like dogs, the whole nine yards, like busted the front door in. And so I went to jail for the first time I got manufacturing, distributing. And then of course, like, I've got more dope than everybody because I'm a dope stealer. I'll steal your dope. So I was stealing from us, and I had extra hits of X in my pocketbook. I had, like, you know, with my license and everything. And so, like, everything, even at the end of it, once he turned himself in, I had more charges than he did because I was hoarding all of our stuff. So anyways, I went to jail, and my family, again, like so many times, you know, things happen where it should have been enough. It should have been that time or that thing or that instant or whatever that that should have been like, okay, Dana, it's time to stop. But you know, so many of those times came and went, and I still fought my way through so I could protect my disease. So my family was trying to, like, get me to, they had hired me an attorney, and they were trying to get me to, what did my brother say? Something about, so I could go out the back door. And I was like, that does not sound, like, when you're hanging out with people called Lopez and Little Man, and, like, I probably don't want to go out the back. I'll just sit in the front with everybody else. You know, I'm terrified. But I'm looking at also going to prison, you know, for like, that was like 2000 when every meth was like, everybody was like locking people up for life for meth, you know. It's so I was terrified. But so he actually turned himself in and he got me an attorney. So then, of course, I was like, bye, family. Like, thanks for everything. But so we bonded out and we were going to stop, you know, because we're terrified. Of course we're going to stop, right? Who does meth when you're out on pretrial? And you have drug tests, you know, and they would give us 7 days and be like, you have 7 days to report. And we'd be like, okay, so really we have 72 hours, right? And so we would do the math. We have 72 hours. And then we would be like, I mean, we could probably, you know, some of these things, they say 48 to 72 hours, you know? So then we would be like, we're like the 48th hour, you know, and we're like smoking meth, like it's going out of style. And then it's like, I mean, 24 hours, maybe, you know, and then we would fail the drug test. And we'd be so shocked. I'd be like, I don't, what happened? One time I was in jail and my brother, you know, and it was of all the places, every time I went to jail, it was the same jail that my brother worked at. So he had his friend come in one time. She was like, what happened? I thought you guys were doing so good. And I was like, I don't know what happened. Did they tell you why I'm here? And she was like, no. And I was like, I think they said something about failing a drug test. And she was like, do you think he put something in your car? And I was like, I don't know. Maybe he did. But it was just denial after denial, you know. And, you know, and during that time, during my addiction, a lot of things happened that I wish were enough to stop me, you know, and I wish that I had known that that I suffer from a disease and not a moral deficiency when I was pregnant, for instance, and hating myself and trying every single day. Every day I woke up saying I was not going to do this, and every single day I did it anyways. And that broke my soul. You know, I just knew when I was pregnant that I would quit. And I didn't. I couldn't. So anyways, that relationship also didn't last all that well, but we didn't really get divorced. We just like changed location. You know, like he lived here and I lived there because we weren't about to go to the courthouse for anything that we, unless we had to, right? So we separated for a little while. And so I had both my daughters, who are beautiful, amazing, gorgeous, sassy little amazing brats, I'll say it that way. And they're perfect, and you know, and that's how I mean, that's one of the ways that I know that my God, or a God of my understanding, has always been with me and always protected me and always looked out for me, because those girls being healthy and being the way they are is absolutely nothing that I did. And that guilt and that shame and that remorse that I carried with me, and that I, you know, that it took me a lot of step work and a lot of years to get through and to get to the other side. And finally, at one point, my sponsor just said, you know what? She said, that was God's grace that took care of them. And every time you beat yourself up, you're robbing God from his grace. And I was like, okay, like, I don't want to rob God. You know, like, so that was one of the things that sort of helped me put down some of that, you know. But I was with these kids. I was raising these kids through the bathroom door. They ate when I ate. They slept when I slept. They went where I went. My 7-year-old daughter, before I got sober, we had a 7-year-old birthday party at the dope house. I mean, that's what we did. And I can remember before I had kids and I was living in the dope house, I remember I would see women, you know, and I like to say that I wasn't snotty like this, but I was. I would see women bring their kids in, and I would be like, who brings their kid to the dope house, you know? And I'm like, this girl was like, there's something in the bathroom that's, like, not for kids. And I'm like, bitch, you're in a dope house. Like, everything here is not for kids. You know, I just remember being so, like, just like, ugh. You know, like, at least I'm not that. But But then I had kids, right? And so you know who takes kids to dope houses? People who have kids who can't stop doing meth. We take them to dope houses. And it don't matter. You know, I could say that it was like the nicest dope house on the street. I mean, I know that sounds crazy, but I mean, it could have been worse. I'll say that. But she had her 7-year-old birthday party at the dope house. And I was so absent from that a few months later when I got clean and sober, for the first year that I was sober, when people asked me how old my kids were, I said 6 and 4. And they weren't. They were 7 and 4. That birthday that we had there, I don't even remember. Or, I mean, I remember, but, like, it didn't even register with me what it was. So, anyways, one day I was taking my kids to school. And another thing, too, that, like, makes you know, like, remember when people would be like, oh, I got pulled over for no insurance and they caught me with meth. And I'd be like, dude, you've got meth. You've got to pay your car insurance, right? Like, what's wrong with you? Well, in 2008, a detective got behind me in the car, and I had no tag. My tag was expired. My license was expired. I had no insurance. And I had just taken my kids to school, and a detective got behind me and pulled me over in my driveway, where my car proceeded to run out of gas while I'm sitting there. Knowing that my driver's license is in my house, because I've been like checking my kids out of school, getting them, you know, I'm like, I'm trying to take care of my meth habit, really. I'm not really trying to take care of these kids, but I'm trying to at least maintain, you know. And so the cop was like, where's your license? And I'm like, well, I'm trying to decide, you know, like, do I say we should go inside and look for it, or should I just go to jail, you know, like, because everything that I have on me right now is bad enough, but if we go inside and you see what I've done with the place, you're probably not going to, it's probably going to be worse. So I start looking through my purse for stuff, and I pull out like a torch lighter, and he was like, what is that for? And I was like, oh, my other car's a convertible, and I smoke, so I need to light my cigarettes. He was like, yeah, okay. Step out of the car, Ms. Davis. So anyway, I went to jail again. You know, my kids were at school. I went to jail. And, you know, this was the first time I went to jail in Douglas County, and they don't have a 24-hour bonding judge, apparently. Initially, what I try to do is what I've done my whole life is protect the meth, right? I mean, I'm like, I've got it. Nobody can find out what I'm doing, and, like, I got to figure out how to get out of here, you know, and I got to call this drug dealer to get me out and that drug dealer to get me there. And come to find out, I had missed my bonding opportunity by a few minutes. So I stay in jail all weekend, and my mom and my stepdad got my kids. And on Monday morning, they went to the courthouse and they filed a dependency case against me, and they saved my kids from me. I was in jail, and the only person, you know, that I could get to bond me out was this dope dealer. And, so he bonded me out, and, my brother called me on Tuesday and said, you got court on Wednesday. We've got the kids, and don't even bother asking us for a ride, because we're not going to give you one. So I was like, okay. So on Wednesday morning, I put on my best outfit, and I walked, because my car, that was actually not even really my car, because I pawned the title. So I guess when the cops realized that it really wasn't my car that ran out of gas in the driveway, they towed it to the proper owner, which was the title pawn, up above the CMA meeting, actually, funny enough. So I walked to the courthouse in the rain, because of course it's going to rain now. And I remember, I mean, that's where I think I did really my first step. I didn't know I was doing it, but I knew that my kids were upstairs with my family. I didn't know who I was up there. I didn't know if my kids were up there. I remember just feeling horrible. I hated myself. I was like, how did you get here? You know, like, why? You now, guess what? Now you're the girl not only that takes her kids to the dope house, but now you're the girl that lost her kids to dope. You know, and it's like that awakening of every single time I was like, well, at least I'm not doing that. it was like, that was like my new goal or something. And then I would be there, you know, and then I would be comfortable there. And then I would be like, well, at least I didn't do that. And then now I'm there, and then I get comfortable there. And then it's like my new life over and over. So I didn't even go upstairs to the hearing. I sat in a ball in on the concrete where all of the people who were going to work were walking in. And, I was just like, what are you going to do? You know, like, what are you going to go up there and fight everybody off and, you know, make a fool of yourself in front of your kids? And, so I didn't, you know, and there, in that battle right there that I was having, like, there was a part of me, like, my disease was like, just leave them. Like, they're better off without you. They're going to be able to give them everything that you couldn't give them, everything that you should have been giving them all along. Just bolt. You know, throw up a do sign and get on down the road. You know how to make this go away. You know how to make yourself feel better. And for whatever reason, I don't know why. I have no idea why. But there was something inside of me that just said fight, you know. And it wasn't the kind of fighting that I've been doing. It wasn't a fight to protect meth. It was a fight for my kids, for my life, you know, for to get my life back. You know, because I never in a million years thought that I would end up where I did, you know, where meth took me. And so I did. My mom took my kids, and I remember watching Kim. She had a few, 4 or 5 years before me, and I remember watching her on MySpace. Yes, that's how old we are. And I remember, like, I knew that she did meth the way I did meth, because I'd read about her in the news, you know, like, she wasn't playing around either. And so I was like, well, I was watching her, and she was doing things, and she was going on trips, and she was like riding NASCAR around, and like she was doing all this cool stuff. And I was like, you know, and I, you know, my dad was in AA, and I go to AA, but I didn't want AA, and I didn't know there was another choice, to be honest with you. But I knew that Kim knew the secret. And so I called Kim. And she was working at her dad's clinic, and I called her, and I said, I think I need to go to a meeting. And it was a Tuesday, and she said, okay, I'll pick you up. And she and another girl picked me up, and I walked out looking like a freak from hell. I had like a backpack. And I had a purse, and I had a book bag, and I had, like, some snacks. And, I mean, I had Pringles and a jar of ranch. I mean, I don't know what I thought I was doing. I don't know what I thought I was doing. But bless her heart, you know, bless her heart. And right before I got into the car, she was like, you don't have anything on you, do you? And I was like, she wants some dope. You know, I was thinking this is not what I thought this was going to be. I was thinking she was asking me if I had any dope to do, you know, and she was like, no, girl, like, you can't get in my car if you have anything on you. And I was like, oh, that's strange. That's not how it used to work. So I went to my first CMA meeting, and I needed there to be a CMA meeting. I needed this meeting to be there. I needed to be around people where I could say I'm a crystal meth addict. I needed to be okay with that, you know. I needed to not be ashamed. I needed to be around people that were willing to talk about it, you know. I remember, so I started going to meetings, you know, and I went to meetings like I did dope all day long, all the time, you know, and I was had a little bit of a identity crisis or something. I don't know what I thought I was hosting the Grammys or something, but I would get up and put my jogger on and walk to the 7:15 meeting, and then I would come home for breakfast and, you know, switch to something a little more casual and wear something to the 11 o'clock meeting for my 11 and my 12:30 meeting, and then I would go up to town and sit across the street from the police department, because from 1:30 to 5:30 there was nothing, and I was terrified. And so I would sit across from the police department until it's time for me to go get on my evening wear. I mean, I don't know what I was thinking, but I was crazy. I mean, bless Kim's heart. You know, I came in a crazy person, like we all do, but, she was so good to me. She was exactly what I needed to be sober. She taught me how to live. One time we went, you know, my mom has my kids all this time, and we were going putt-putt to putt-putt, a bunch of us. And I started, you know, I started thinking, why am I, how are you here? You know, like, your kids aren't with you, and, like, you're having fun, and you're putt-putting, and, you know, who knows what your kids are thinking, or if they're wondering about you. And I had all this guilt and stuff, and I told Kim, I was like, I need to go home. You know, I can't be doing this. I can't be doing this when I don't have my kids. And she said, you need to do this while you don't have your kids. You need to learn how to do this, and you need to learn how to do it sober. And she said, so you're not going anywhere, first of all, because I drove, because she had power issues. First of all, you're not going anywhere because I drove. And second of all, you're not going anywhere because this is what we do. This is how we do it, you know. And so I remember the very first Plowin Canyon that I went to. And that's kind of where I had one of my, the first, like, spiritual awakening, I guess you could say. I think I picked up a 60-day chip on that trip. So I had 60 days. We had been coming to Galano on Friday nights, and I loved, you know, the meeting in Douglasville is a little bit smaller, and it's a little bit more noticeable when you get up every 5 seconds to smoke a cigarette or look outside to see if anybody else is coming or whatever I was doing. So when I came here, you know, there was like more people, and it was kind of like, you know, I wasn't the only person running out the door to smoke a cigarette every 5 minutes sometimes. And even if I was, if I sat in the back, nobody really could see me. But, you know, I loved this meeting. I felt connected to this meeting. I needed to see that there was not just about 10 people in Douglasville. I needed to see that there were people everywhere. That there were people everywhere trying to stop doing meth. You know, I had no idea that I could go a day, a minute. I didn't think I could do it. You know, every event that I imagined myself going through, I imagined myself going through it with meth, you know? We were at Cloudland Canyon, and my friend and I were sitting around the campfire, and it was just the two of us. And we were talking about, you know, different things, and she was saying, you know, your secrets keep you sick, and, you know, all of those things that they tell us. And I remember thinking, yeah, well, I'm probably going to be sick because I've got some stuff I'm not going to tell, you know? And for whatever reason, we were in front of that campfire, and my friend said something, and I told her about this thing that happened that I did when my kids were little. I had put them to bed for a nap in my bed. Normally, my youngest daughter would have been in the baby bed. And so while they were asleep taking a nap, I, you know, was doing my thing. And I was like, this is a great time to put the baby book together. So I went into the nursery and with my torch lit, and I went to get the baby book stuff out from underneath the baby bed. And I went back, and then at some point I realized that I had caught the baby bed on fire. Like, the center of the baby bed was in flames. And I told her that. And I was expecting her to be like, you know what, girl, you know, we got to draw the line somewhere. You know, I expected her to reject me. I expected her to be like, well, you might should have held on to that one. And she wasn't. And she told me that every single thing that has happened to me led me to the place that I was today, and that it was okay. And I needed to hear that. I needed to hear that it was okay for me to say some of the things out loud that I had been horrified of, you know, that I had done. Some of these things that I've done, I'm just like, who does that? And I needed that, you know, I needed her to say that. I remember, you know, when I came in, I don't know what in the world I was thinking, but I came in wearing a camouflage hat and straight down like I was some kind of hardcore. My ringtone was crazy, bitch. And sometimes I would, like, not turn the ringer off on purpose because I wanted everybody to. I don't know why. I mean, like, that's crazy. That is crazy, bitch. Right? But, like, I came in like a tornado. I remember doing my first step. I remember doing my second step. I remember Kim telling me I had to memorize the third step prayer. And I was like, what? You know, like, memorize? Like, old maid or something? Like, I haven't memorized anything since I was in school. But I did, you know, everything she said to me sounded crazy, and I did it anyways. I was willing to do it. I didn't want to use meth ever again. You know, I never wanted my kids to wonder where I was again. I never wanted them to be like, I never wanted to take them to school and never show back up again. You know, I was terrified. And so I did everything that they asked me to do. I remember, you know, doing my fourth step, and I remember Kim taking me out on behind the house on a rock at a pond. Like, it's, I know it sounds like a fairy tale fourth step or something, but for whatever reason, that's the way we did it. But I remember it. I remember what it felt like. I remember her saying, "So you weren't, you had no fear in that?" When I came in, I didn't want you to think I was afraid of anything, because that felt, you know, I wanted you to think I was mad about everything. That's easier for me. It's easier for me to be mad than it is for me to be sad. I remember going through that list, and I remember telling, you know, I remember putting people on that never list. I'm never going to make an amends to that person. And she let me do that, you know. When I had my first, I don't know why, I probably shouldn't tell this, but it's about to come out, so here we go. One of the first book studies that I went to, I mean, I feel like I just wanted to be, I wanted you to think that I was tough, or I wanted you to think that I was bad or whatever. I mean, I'm in CMA meeting. I don't have to tell you who I am. You know, I walk through the front door, so you guys know who I am. But I'll tell this funny story. I walked into my first book study. It was an AA meeting, and there was this quirky guy, and he was reading out loud, and they were on page 10 of the big book. The very end of the first full paragraph, and it said, I just walked in and sat down beside him, and he read. Should I not say this? Anyway, he was like, "They made me swallow hard," right? And so I was like, I'm like texting him with my flip phone. I was like, this guy's crazy. She's like, where are you at? I was like, I'm at this group, and it's a book study. She's like, well, it's probably in the book, Dina. So I look at him, I'm like, sure enough, it's right there. So that became our thing, right? So when everything was going crazy and things were like rough, I'd be like, swallow hard, bitch. You know? And so that was like our little thing, right? And so my very first birthday, I finally get sober here, and I'm so excited. I get effing Denise to tell her story. I don't know why you guys call her that, but I heard her share one time, and so I was like, I want her to tell her story at my birthday. And so I invited my grandmother and my dad, who's like hardcore AA, you know, big book thumper, and I invite all of them. So Kim gets me a cake. What do you think it says on it? Swallow hard. Gets me a little bracelet with that engraved from Things Remembered. Swallow hard. Imagine like going there and saying that that's what you're here for. And then I realize why y'all call her effing Denise. Because she says effing for everything. But she don't say effing. It was fucking this and effing that. And I was like, oh my God. I was like, what have I done? You know, and I'm looking over at my grandmother and I'm looking at my dad. And I'm like, this is horrible. But at the end of the day, it really wasn't horrible. The fact that I stayed clean and sober and didn't touch meth for a full year is, I mean, it blew my mind, right? And it set me on fire. And for this program, it set me on fire for recovery, you know. And there was a group of women when I first got sober, and we surrounded ourselves with each other, and they protected me, and they dared anybody to mess with me. I didn't have to worry about anything, you know. I was willing to tell them everything, and I was willing to take suggestions from them. And, you know, that tight group, they called us the wolf pack, whatever. During the few years, at some point, Kim and I sort of, we started changing. And, you know, I feel like maybe now I look back and I think maybe God was protecting me then, you know, and I don't know. So there was a lady that was a single mom, and she had raised a son, and she had bought a house, and she had a job, and she seemed to be a better fit for me. And so Kim was no longer my sponsor, and this woman was my sponsor, and she taught me how to be a strong single mom. And I raised my kids, and I raised them in this program, and I've got, I think I started something over there and then I didn't do it. So anyways, I'm back here. My kids, they know this program. I remember initially I was like, my kids will never go to a meeting. And somebody said, didn't you say one of them had a birthday in a dope house? And I was like, oh yeah. So they have been brought up and they've been taught, you know, in school situations, in life situations, like, what's your part? Clean your side of the street, you know, do the next right thing. That all of those things that I learned as an adult, my kids have learned, you know, as kids. You know, I can remember my youngest daughter being like, we had a crazy morning one time, and she was probably like six, and I remember just thinking, oh my God, like, this is crazy. And she said, Mommy, can we start the day over? And I was like, oh yeah. You know, I'm like, oh yeah, that's great. That's great. Great job, kid. Let's do that. You know, so I'm like, everybody close your eyes and let's pretend the alarm. But like, she knows that today, you know, she knows that she doesn't have to have a bad day just because she had a bad moment. And it was being around this room, you know, these rooms, that's where she learned that. The group of women, you know, we all kind of did our, some of us stayed sober, some of us didn't. Some of us had fights, some of us didn't. But there was a time when we found out that Kim wasn't doing good. And we all came together and we decided we were going to go try to talk to her, you know. We'd never been to her house. She was dating this guy. And we didn't really know where she lived. We just had an address, and we all met at Publix, and we all held hands in a circle, and we prayed. And we hopped in a minivan, and we drove to her house, and we knocked on the door, and she at first was just kind of looking at us like, what is going on, you know? And but she let us in, and we all sat around her den, and we got to tell her what she did for us, you know? And I got to tell her what my life looks like now because of her and because of her introduction and for what she gave, the gift of recovery that she showed me how to do, you know. And I held her hand, and we all just went around the room, and I had no idea that would be the last time that I saw her. But that was a gift, you know. That was a gift that that we all got to do that, and we got to tell her, you know, how important she was and how amazing she was and what she did for us, you know. And you know, when I work with sponsees today, I do it the same way she did it with me, you know. The first before they sold the house, I called her brother and I was like, is there any way I can like borrow the pond for a few hours, you know? And I took my sponsee out there because that's the way she did it, you know. That's the way it was done for me. This program has given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. You know, before I started using everything, there was a time when I used to imagine my life and dream about, you know, what this was going to be or what that was going to be. And then there was a long time where none of that happened. I didn't dream about anything. The only thing I thought about was meth and how I could get it and where I was going to do it and who was going to give it to me. And, you know, like my whole everything revolved around meth. And today I don't have to live like that, you know. This program has given me a life. It's given my kids their mom back. They don't have to wonder where I'm at, if I'm going to pick them up, you know. I remember before I got sober, I remember thinking about when my oldest, you know, like when they graduated, and I'm thinking, where, you know, like, what am I going to do when they graduate? Like, I'm going to need meth then, you know. And I literally am thinking about this, you know, or when I'm old and like, who's going to go to the store and buy my meth pipes and, you know, when I can't drive anymore. Like, that's the way I thought about my future. It became everything about meth. And this past June, my daughter graduated from high school. Wow. And I didn't have to do meth. And it was amazing, you know, and all of those things that I thought meth was going to be a part of has not been a part of any of those things. And today, you know, when I think about what their life would have looked like if I hadn't got sober, it would have been tragic. I talk to them about everything. They're educated about this disease. They know what their chances are. You know, they know things that I didn't know that could have changed my life. And I hope that, you know, giving them information, it's not going to save them, but at least it's going to, you know, guard them. Yeah. So that's my meth story. Thanks for letting me share.